You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Jamaica Kincaid has an extraordinary ability to evoke with equal vividness both inner and outer worlds. One critic used the word unblinking to describe her writing, and rereading her work over this weekend, I was thinking that is such an accurate description of her writing about subjects as disparate as her younger brother dying of AIDS or an arduous hike in the Himalayas to collect seeds. This little paragraph, which I'm going to read to you from her book Among Flowers, A Walk in the Himalayas, about that epic hike, hints at an essence of her work to me. She writes, quote, "This account of a walk I took while gathering seeds of flowering plants in the foothills of the Himalaya can have its origins in my love of the garden, my childhood love of botany and geography, my love of feeling isolated, of imagining myself all alone in the world and everything unfamiliar, or the familiar being strange, my love of being afraid, but at the same time not letting my fear stand in the way, my love of things that are far away, but things I have no desire to possess." Her fiction vividly and often harrowingly describes the difficult coming of age of strong-minded girls who, very much like herself, were born into tropical poverty. Jamaica Kincaid was born and raised in Antigua and moved to New York to work as an au pair, as a servant, as she writes, when she was 17. In 1976, and of course there's some time in between, her writing attracted the attention of William Shawn, the former editor of the longtime legendary editor of The New Yorker, where she became a staff writer and a featured columnist for many years. In his introduction to Kincaid's collection of Talk of the Town pieces from The New Yorker, her good friend and colleague during her tenure there, Ian Fraser, writes, "A lot of the exhilaration those years for me was in seeing who could be the bravest, who could be the coolest. I kept a mental scorecard of brave and cool deeds. I saw New Yorker veterans come into the office an hour or two before an issue's deadline and in one draft turn out Talk of the Town stories as elegant and effortless as Will Rogers' rope trick. But to me, nobody was braver than Jamaica. She didn't try to be shocking or transgressive or audacious. Those imitations of bravery done mainly for effect, her bravery was just the way she was, and it came natural and uninterrupted from inside." She has published four novels, Annie John, Lucy, The Autobiography of My Mother, and Mr. Potter, a story collection, At the Bottom of the River, a book-length essay about Antigua titled A Small Place, a memoir about her youngest sibling who died of AIDS in 1996, My Brother, a collection of writing on gardening, My Garden, an anthology of her New Yorker Talk of the Town pieces, and a most unusual travel memoir, Among Flowers, about her hike in the Himalayas. And you can read an excerpt from her forthcoming novel. She's going to read a little bit from it tonight, See Now Then, in the wonderful literary magazine Little Star, which we have for sale tonight with her books. She began her academic career at Harvard, holding joint appointments in the English and African American Studies Department. She taught for many years at Bennington College in Vermont, and she is currently a professor of literature at Claremont McKenna College. We're very fortunate to have her in Southern California now. She's received numerous awards and honors, including a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund Writers Award, and she was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 2004 and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2009. And tonight she will read from a new work and discuss her writing with Bridget Mullins, who's currently the director of the Master of Professional Writing Program at USC. Bridget is an award-winning playwright and poet. Her work includes Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater, and Pathological Venus. Among her current theater projects are a site-specific piece with the Imaginist Theater at Ann Hamilton's Tower in Northern California. And in addition to her achievements as a writer, she is a superb mentor and an indispensable and cherished colleague who enriches the literary life of our community in countless ways. After their conversation, they'll open up to you for questions. Please wait until the microphone comes to you as we record for podcast. And please join me in welcoming Jamaica Kincaid and Bridget Mullins. Thank you.
Oh, now it doesn't do what it's supposed to. Yes, I'm going to read parts of a chapter from a novel that I will publish shortly and hope I will persuade you after reading from it to purchase it. It is called See Now Then, and it will be evident that it's about a family of two children, a mother and a father, who live in a village in New England, and they live in a house that, according to them, someone named Shirley Jackson used to live in, and they don't tell you who Shirley Jackson is. So if you want to know, you'll have to go somewhere else. They won't tell you who that is. And it's just a family. And there are other characters in it. There are the main characters in it. And it will also become evident to you, the main characters, other than the Shirley Jackson house, which is a main character also. So this particular chapter is called... the novel is called See Now Then, and this chapter is called The Dean and Mrs. Hess. There are actually two people named the Dean and Mrs. Hess, but the characters in the novel will not tell you who they are either. So if you wish to know that, you will have to find this out on your own. It's just something that I, as the author, have perversely decided to keep from you. All right, so it goes like this, part of the chapter. That afternoon, at exactly 3:45, the young Heracles got off the school bus and found that his mother, the dear Mrs. Sweet, was not waiting to pick him up. He saw the old school bus, driven by the madly named Mr. Strange, disappear around the corner below the Bennington Monument. He saw his companions, some wayward boys who lived in a village that was surrounded by evergreens of every kind, except for broadleaf, and the evergreens were all sick with a blight of rust. And these boys were very bad, for sometimes they pummeled almost to death the young Heracles, and the force required to restrain himself from gathering them up altogether in his large brown hands and making them as lifeless as his old socks was greater than the force he had used to smite the entire city of Thebes as it appeared in his handheld Nintendo game. Those boys, in any case, had names of no distinguished origin, their names being Jamie, Kaelin, Rainier, and such. But the bus stop was empty of Mrs. Sweet, and the young Heracles was beside himself with anxiety and sorrow, for he loved his mother so, and only so. And a dark cloud of a toxic fire emerged from his forehead, and he directed it toward the top of the Bennington Monument and caused it to fall to the ground, just missing a bus full of citizens from Germany who were taking a tour of New England in the spring. So beside himself was Heracles with anger and grief over Mrs. Sweet not being there to greet him when the school bus arrived, that he sank to the ground, drew his feet up into his chest. His chin rested on his knees so that he looked like an illustration of a fully developed child intact in his mother's womb, an illustration commonly found in the walls of a doctor's office. "Oh, come on!" And that was the voice of the beautiful Persephone, his sister, and that is as it should be, for it was spring, and she was released from living in the depths of the pocket of Mr. Sweet's old Brooks Brothers tweed jacket. And the lining of that pocket, which was made of silk purchased in Hong Kong, was shredded, and poor beautiful Persephone suffered. Not knowing what else to do, she lifted him up with much ease, as if he were an ear of corn, or a pint of strawberries, or a plate of peas, or as if she were removing the hamster that died overnight from its cage, and she placed him in the right-hand pocket of her jacket, which was made from polyethylene teraphthalate, and the pocket itself was lined with rayon. "Now, now," she said, as she stroked the curve of his back with her thumb, her forefingers shielding his head, which rested against his knees. "It is very bad that she's not here to meet us once again when we get off the bus from school. Where the hell could she be? What the hell could she be doing? Oh, she just sits in that room writing about her goddamn mother, as if people had never had a mother that wanted to kill them before they were born in the history of the world. And the stupid father named Mr. Potter, who couldn't even read, and the fucking stupid little island in which he was born, full of stupid people who history would be happy to forget, but she has to keep reminding everybody, and no one cares, and she can't stand it. And where is she? She's in that little room off the kitchen, and from that room she can see the kitchen, and she's making us whatever we all want to eat, and none of us wants to... none of us wants the same thing. And how she manages to keep writing that shit. Make her stop before I kill her. And it was so much better when she would only knit her stockings that were too big before they were washed, and then were too small after they were washed. And they just gathered dust in the wash basket because she couldn't bear to throw them out after all the time she'd spent knitting them. And the hats never kept you warm. They fell into our eyes when we were skiing. And I almost killed myself coming down that black diamond wearing the stupid hat she had stayed up making for me as a present. And it is the stupid writing. It is the stupid writing. It is the stupid writing that's keeping her from being on time to meet the school bus, which was driven by Mr. Strange. Ralph is his name, too. And that is not a name with a distinguished lineage. And a man, you know, just a man who should be locked up in a jail in a cell that is underground, could come and pick us up and take us to his house and murder us and violate us sexually. And we would never be seen again or heard of again, not even to be mentioned on the nightly news. Vanish from the face of the earth like a species from a geological era that isn't even yet detected. What is she doing? What is she doing? What the hell is she doing? She's sitting there in that room at the big desk that Donald made for her, and she's thinking of a sentence and the way to end it. My mother would kill me if she got the chance. I would kill my mother if I had the courage. And as if such a thing was possible, she lives in that world of the room with the desk and the kitchen just beyond, and she leaves us here all alone for a man to murder us. For tourists from Germany to stare at us, for all the other children and their mothers to see that she doesn't love us. She only loves that world that she carries around in her head, a torrent of lies all in her head, where nothing to her, nothing, nothing, only those words in her head. And now, look, the night is coming. The ink-black night is going to swallow us up, and we will never be found, for we will be lost in the night. Where is she? Where is she? Then, oh, just then, Mrs. Sweet appeared in the old car, the old grey Cuniclos, the old car Mrs. Sweet fondly called Mr. McGregor, for she so loved to personalize everything, as if everything in the whole world was made solely for her. And when she saw her two children, she blew up like a souffle, and actually, right in her mind right then, was the menu for dinner, crab souffle, a green leaf salad with a fresh vinaigrette, ice cream, if the children wanted it, from the store, not ice cream she had made herself. That she only did in the summer. She was very proud of them. And why? She couldn't say. Not now, not then. But the children were glad to see her, or so she thought then. His sister had released the young Heracles from her pocket the minute she caught sight of the old grey Cuniclos as it crested the hill just in front of the Gatlin house. The young Heracles had unfolded himself from that eternal position, and now he looked fresh, like a flower just opening, or like a flower just opening as seen in a time-lapsed film. Mrs. Sweet gathered up her dear children in her arms and drew them close to her with eyes closed, as if they were a fragrant bouquet of Lilium Nepalens, just then picked. But rarely, though, she hustled them into the back of the old car, and there was mould growing on the floor. The roof of the car had a leak in it. The door on the driver's side did not close properly, letting in rain or snow, as the case may be. In third gear, she turned onto Silk Road, crossed the Wallumsack River at the covered bridge, swiftly rounding the curves on the Matteson Road, making a left on Harlan, and then home to the house in which Shirley Jackson had once lived. But that journey whom then? What of it? What of it now? For Forrest stands between the covered bridge and Shirley Jackson's house, and just this, and just as they approached it, Persephone wet her lips, and just as they crossed its boundary, she then burst into song. Not a song with everyday notes, not a song heard on the radio, and then again it was not even a real song. It was a series of pitch sounds, each of them different. And they came in rows of 12, or maybe 13, or 14, but 12 seemed more plausible, or so Mrs. Sweet thought, but she only thought this. She didn't know with certainty, then or now, as she writes this. And those rows of notes that were the same and then were not, for the orderings were not expected, thought Mrs. Sweet, and that was when she didn't want to put a large man's athletic sock in the opening of the beautiful Persephone's mouth. And the orderings were random, thought Mrs. Sweet, and that was when she wanted to throw the beautiful Persephone into an oblivion that was solely the heavens, a place where she would be held until Mrs. Sweet could bear her very presence again. And the beautiful Persephone sang as if she were backed by an entire orchestra, a lavish one, as if she were in a great hall, and an audience with no defining physical characteristics, no broad noses, no fine and yellow hair, an indifferent complexion, removed from historical events, were listening to her. But to the ears of the other occupants of the old Kuniklos, a car that was made in Germany but bore a Greek name, how annoying to hear the contents of the Delia catalogue in that way. How annoying to hear the contents of the Wet Seal catalogue in that way. How annoying to hear the contents of the beautiful Persephone's desires in that way. She sang on, though sing, that act, so associated often with the feeling of being transported out of your current state of mind into another realm, a realm of something other than our real selves, was not what the beautiful Persephone did. She sang, and the singing itself was beautiful, and she sang of the tweed coat whose hem fell just below the knee, and the tweed coat that was cut in the style of a seaman in the British Navy, and of the dress that was made from barrels of oil, that had been wrought into fabric that looked like gossamer, and a dress of surreal beauty was fashioned from it. And she sang of the skirt that had wide pleats and was short, and of the skirt that had narrow pleats and was long, and of the boots that were thick-soled, and of the boots that came up to the knee, and the boots that could not even be considered worth wearing by the beautiful Persephone or her friend, the flame-haired lamb who lived on Mechanic Street, or her friend who lived on the ramparts of a mountain in North Adam, Massachusetts, or her many other friends who lived in the summer along with her in Camp Eisner, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Her voice at the same 12th pitch, and then in a row that might be familiar, and then unexpectedly not, or so it seemed to poor, benighted Mrs. Sweet's ears, for Mrs. Sweet only knew of Anglican hymns, and then The Mighty Sparrow, and then Motown, and then Disco, and then the young Heracles, Love Jay-Z. How cruel to make you love one thing 12 times and then change to something else, and make you love that, and then change to something else, and make you love that too, and then make the thing you love new, and not tell you, and then you love that too, and then change to something you had forgotten, and make you love that too, and then change to something you know and loved then, and love now, and make you think you don't know it at all. How cruel. So thought Mrs. Sweet, as she drove her children to their home, the house that was the house Shirley Jackson had lived in. And as Mrs. Sweet approached the house, that beautiful house, white, with Doric columns, built in something called a Victorian style, she thought that might the 12 pitches in a row, and then repeated over and over again, and then changed unexpectedly, be as beautiful as trees arranged in rows of 5 diagonally placed and evenly spaced, and so therefore be called a quincox, and that this repetition, this design, is so restful to the spirit, and Mrs. Sweet could testify to this, for she once saw this very thing in the woodland part of a garden in Tuscany. The 12 rows of notes, each the same, each varying slightly one from the other, so it seemed to Mrs. Sweet's untutored and third world attuned ears, came to a sudden end. The beautiful Persephone shut her mouth, and Mrs. Sweet brought the grey car, which was named by the Maker to honour a rodent, much loved by children and hated by anyone with an unfenced vegetable garden, to an abrupt stop. The children said, "Jesus Christ, Mom," and "Oh, fuck, Mom," as their bodies lurched forward and then were restrained by the seat belts, which Mrs. Sweet always insisted they wear, and this unexpected flirtation with disaster would have been a delight and a thrill were it to take place on a ride in an amusement park, not in the driveway of their own home, sweet home. Seeing then now, that's more... Sorry. And at dinner, the souffle had not enough salt in it, too much salt in it, not enough crab in it, too much crab in it. The crab was stale, that was certain, frozen. For how can there be fresh crab in a village in a state that was landlocked? There are no land-dwelling crabs here. The salad was limp. Mrs. Sweet had poured the vinaigrette over the tender leaves for a long time before it was eaten. The beautiful Persephone made an island out of her salad as it sat on her plate. The collapsed portion of souffle was a beach where a vicious pirate of Elizabethan times ruled, or where vicious people of Harlem sunned themselves, because winter in Holland can sometimes be vicious. The world is vicious, thought Mrs. Sweet to herself, as she sat with her husband and two children at the dinner table. Mr. Sweet said in a loud voice, as if he were in a stage and addressing an audience, "All the tulips your mother planted last autumn were eaten by the deer. The deer came and ate them all, just as they were about to bloom, just as they had reached that point in budding before bursting into bloom. The deer came and ate them. Each bud a delicious, juicy morsel of something that was perhaps holy, perhaps not. But they ate them, chowed down on them, devoured them, leaving your poor mother nothing but tall stalks of green. Where there should have been glistening with dew, queen of the night, queen of Holland, black parrot, the little Clusiana Cynthia, Lady Jane, the Humulus Alba Corolla, Turkestanica, Colopowskiana, Linifolia, Kaufmannia hybrids and Grigii, where there should have been single early blooms of purple prince, white marvel, and Christmas orange, where there should have been double early blooms of Mondial, Monsella, and Monte Carlo, where there should have been lily flowering blooms of Mariette, Marilyn, and Mona Lisa, where there should have been Mrs. Sheepers, especially Mrs. Sheepers, for that is Mrs. Sweet's favorite of all tulips, where there should have been all these treasures that she had looked forward to all winter, sitting in the bathtub and drinking ginger ale and eating oranges way into the middle of the night, dreaming of tulips and dreaming of ways to be alive, which only enrage me, and she does it solely to enrage me, for I want her dead. Beautiful Persephone and I want her dead. Beautiful Persephone and I would ask young Heracles to kill her, but he loves her so much. But now, this moment, this now, what happiness, for the deer ate her tulips just as they were all about to open in a glorious bloom." And the two children burst into applause and clapped their hands and held their glasses of milk in the air, even spilling some of the liquid onto their plates with the food that now looked like something to be described by people interested in the obscure and unusual. And then they burst into a chorus of, "Who got your turban? Dear got your turban. Who ate your turban? Dear ate your turban. Who got your turban? Dear got your turban." Call and response, response and call, and it all reached a crescendo that broke to the ground. 12 discordant notes, none of them meant to be together. Mommy, 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 mom, Mrs. Sweet's children sat across from her. Their breath was her breath, and it smelled of all the sweet things she had given them, and their names were Persephone and Heracles. Gathering her children to her bosom, Mrs. Sweet soothed them with kisses, reminding them that they loved her then, not only just then, but then when they were babies and couldn't fall asleep without her milk-yielding breasts into their mouths, of then when they couldn't cross the road and she had to show them how, of then when young Heracles could be lulled into a stupor by taking him to a place where men, who were in the process of realizing some marvel of engineering, operated huge machinery, and the machines made noises that were so loud you could not hear yourself think, of then when she took them to see the continental divide and a receding glacier in the state of Montana, and unexpectedly she found a species of Clematis columbiana in bloom right outside the kitchen of the motel where they were staying, and inside their breakfast was being cooked. And this was just before she learned that the path to a lake named to commemorate a woman who would have been a pain to have as a friend was closed because some German tourists had been knocked down to the ground by a grizzly bear the day before. The bear's real prey had been a baby elk swimming in the lake with its mother. Herding her children up to their room in the upstairs of the Shirley Jackson house, Shirley Jackson being a woman who had been long dead by the time Mrs. Sweet was living in that house, and a woman Mrs. Sweet would never know. But her being, nevertheless, was all too present, even as it was unknown to Mrs. Sweet as she went about the everyday. Mrs. Sweet tossed them into their beds, and that was without incident, for by that time putting the children to bed was such an ordeal for dear Mrs. Sweet, so full of bargains made around the packed lunch. Would Mrs. Sweet put extra Oreos for the beautiful Persephone to share with Jory, whose parents did not allow her to have sugary things? Would Mrs. Sweet allow the young Heracles to have a playdate with Gregory, whose parents were devout Christians and attached to some branch and sect that Mrs. Sweet could not understand? And after all, she allowed the young Heracles to go to Gregory's house for a visit, though at the same time she prayed or wished, prayers and wishes then being interchangeable and undistinguishable, that no harm would come to him, and no harm ever came to him when he visited Gregory's house. All the same, Mrs. Sweet was so relieved to hear that Gregory was soon moving to Florida. But just before he could let go of her, before he sensed she was longing to go back to that much-hated room, the room just off the kitchen, the room in which she would commune with the vast world that began in 1492, the room in which lay her mother and her brother and her other brothers and all the other people that she sought out, even as they turned their backs on her. That room, burn it down, cried her children. Burn it down with her in it, cried Mr. Sweet. But Mrs. Sweet knew of no other way to be, and in any case did not know that her existence and her way of being caused so much as a stir in others. But just before he could let go of her, just before he drifted off to sleep, a state of being he fought mightily against, for Heracles sought to dominate, not to be dominated, he said to his mother, "Mom, Mom, oh, Mom, tell me again of the Dean and Mrs. Hess." And he was referring to those tales of two deep sea-dwelling creatures, a man and a woman, who were married to each other and who did this without having gills and without having lungs. The Dean and Mrs. Hess possessed neither lungs nor gills, for they did not live beneath water or on dry land, for they were not yet of this earth, but they did see the earth grow dense and large and larger still. They did see an inner core become covered with an outer core, and then that become covered over by a mantle. "Well, look at that," said Mrs. Hess to the Dean, just as inner core disappeared beneath outer core, and then outer core disappeared beneath mantle. At that, the Dean adjusted his glasses. "This is exhausting," he said, and Mrs. Hess said, "You think so? Just wait till we have children." The Dean wanted to say, "What's that?" But he knew that Mrs. Hess hated just then any unusual amount of irony, and she might interpret his attempt at humour as inappropriate. He said nothing. He looked at his wife, her hair beautiful rust, her eyes the colour of a fire as it is reflected in the glass eyes of the two cats that decorated the end irons in the hearth of a fireplace in New England in mid-November. He looked at his wife as she spun around and around, first in one direction, then in another, in an effort to make herself at one with the earth's own turning. She failed and sank to her own centre. And the dean said, "What's that?" And after that, for a while, he was molten and silent. And then he boiled up, not in resentment and anger, but in laughter and much clapping, with approval at his own happiness. He loved Mrs. Hess. He loved her so much. He bombarded her with kisses, which she sensibly ignored, but took note of nevertheless. "Is it time for dinner?" asked the dean, and Mrs. Hess replied firmly, "Not yet." And time moved on in the way it always would, always will, then and now intertwined, losing uniqueness, difference, distinction, subject only to laws of human consciousness. "Mom, Mom, what's happening? Where's the time when the dean throws the plateful of hot horse chestnuts, fresh from being roasted in the immortal fire? You know, the fire that is burning forever at the center of the earth, the one that is waiting to turn us back into the thing from which we came, that thing called the universe? Where is that? Can you get to that chapter, please? I want to hear about the millions of years of rain. Can you skip to that? Please, Mom, please, Mom." And that was the young Heracles interrupting the sweet mellifluous tone of Mrs. Sweet as she read to him the story of creation, the story of how he now was then, the very story, the nature of any story, the story being the definition of chaos, of the unstable, of the uncertain, of the pause that holds the possibility of nothingness, empty. But Mrs. Sweet continued in her steady voice, for the personality of the reassuring mother came readily and easily to her. She said, while speaking for Mrs. Hess, "It rained a kind of water that was so complicated with various elements of each of them, with various elements, and each of them separately or combined, it would not matter, would be inhospitable to the life of the mosquito, who was a vector of the most virulent form of malaria, and it rained for 100 million years." The young Heracles said, oh, Mom, can we go to Africa?" But Mrs. Sweet, still speaking as Mrs. Hess, said, "Not yet is there an Africa, not yet is there an Africa," saying it twice, for that would make it really so, and it was really so then, and it really is so now.
Should I go on? Listen.
"Well, enough of this young man," said Mrs. Sweet. For she could see the to and fro of travelling to Africa, undifferentiated from now and then, just a landmass emerging from billions of years of the earth's relentless unrestiveness, the earth indifferent to a unique individual consciousness as it might manifest itself in Mrs. Sweet, the dean and Mrs. Hess, or anything as such. And she brought the bedsheets and down comforter, mixed up as they were, sheets and comforter, to his chin, and folded them around his body as if he was in a shroud, but he was only going to sleep, and would wake up the next morning, not going to sleep forever. For he lay in the bottom half of his bunk bed that Mrs. Sweet had purchased from Crate and Barrel, and Mr. Sweet had objected to the cost of it. The top half was left for his friends Matt and Gregory and Kaelin and Rainier, and such were their names, and they were not afraid to fall out of a bed so high up from the floor, or so they said, and the young Heracles did not believe them. And just before she left him, just before she showed him the moon and said, "Good night," Mrs. Sweet said, "Tomorrow is another day, and what will you do then?" For she was familiar with seeing now and seeing then. But the young Heracles was already asleep, or in any case dreaming. Mrs. Sweet closed tightly the book that contained the adventures of the Dean and Mrs. Hess, but the Dean and Mrs. Hess were not concerned at all. They continued as always, as before and after, as they do now. The Dean's glasses slipped down from the thin banister that was his nose for a moment of millions of years in the realms of the batholiths and into formations of thickened fluids that solidified into granite, rocks, becoming stilled through cooling or through heating, for heat could make movement stilled. Oh yes, said the Dean and Mrs. Hess to each other as they traversed the deep realm before there was any surface that was habitable, and they were creating a surface which could be habitable, but they were not at all interested in that then. Mrs. Hess said to the Dean, look at this, and the Dean twisted his head to see what she wanted him to see, and while doing so, he drank a barrel of wine whose grapes had been harvested from a secretion of a valley called Sonoma, and Mrs. Hess did not know of it, and she could not know that this was one of the many instances or ways in which she could never know the Dean, and the Dean, as he swallowed this liquid with a fervor that could be accurately described in a soap opera, did not know anything, for all of that now was to come, even as it was to be then. Thank you.
One thing about hearing Jamaica is, as most of you have probably read her incredible work, you know the amount of vocal energy it takes because these sentences are so long and so sublime, and you get into this cadence. I was thinking of a phrase, I forget who said it, but somebody said it's as if thought plunged into a sea of words and came up dripping. And you get this feeling that there's this depth charge with description. Do you need help?
Yes, I'm giving the man upstairs a nightmare. It's just what he wanted, warned me against. Ay, ay, ay.
I think you said, yeah.
Is it all right? I'm so sorry. Thank you.
That was a beautiful reading.
Thank you very much.
That's kind. Yes, is it have you read from it before? Is
this I must have. I think yes, I have, but where did I yes, I have read from it before, and it's I can't remember exactly, but I know I have because I read it with more confidence than now. I actually didn't care that you liked it or even understood it. I hope you did. But usually I hesitate to read things, and I much prefer to read old things because there they are. But new things is more... So I think I have read it before. Not exactly a question we need to, but
ponder.
But, yes.
But well, the other thing I'm thinking about when I hear you read and when I read it was there are always these, or in this piece in particular, these amazing names: Heracles, who's the strongest Greek hero, and Persephone, who's the goddess of the underworld, and Mrs. Sweet. And I just wondered about these names, that Mr. Strange, the bus driver. They're just wonderful. It's like a fairy tale.
Well, all the names, they're real in some way. Mr. Strange really was a bus driver of the... I perhaps shouldn't personalize it too much because a lot of the... names are real, and I'm sure there'll be some people who, in another part I can tell you because you'll see the book. There really there is someone in it named Homer, but Homer really was a person in the village, and it I can't tell whether I have a keen sense of observation. I'm willing to say I don't. But if you were to credit me with such a thing, I wouldn't mind. Or I am just very lucky. But it is true that I started to write about these two characters, the children's names, and then in a certain village without remembering that a key person in the story would be a man named Homer who builds things. And he has a... I think you read that part of it. Or the Mr., the name of the family being Sweet. I named them that because I remember that earlier in another part of my life, someone who at the same time professed to love me very much but was causing me a great deal of pain used to call me Sweetie. Mm. So I named the family that because it's they're not sweet, though they say lovely, sweet things out loud to each other, but when they're not speaking to each other, what they really think is the opposite of sweet. So I wanted to write about family life, and it's full of also, but not just family life, all like, for instance, I mean, just to be clear, it's very kind of you all to come to see me and so on, but at some point you'll say, God, she's such an idiot. And it's all right. It's complicated.
Well, I don't think anyone will say that or think that, but the one thing that also strikes me, and I know many of us here have read all of Jamaica Kincaid's work at least once or twice, maybe three times, some of us. And
she's speaking for herself.
Well, and I know some of you in the audience as well. And there's this, the voice of the daughter is so funny and so reminds me of the voice of Girl. And there's this kind of like, when she's railing against the mother, she is in the little room, she is writing, who the hell wants to read? That whole litany is just so striking and so funny.
I didn't know that it was funny. I actually know funny people, and they make me laugh a lot. So I always hope... I think being funny is the greatest thing. To be a funny person is just incredibly desirable. In that way, I'm an American. Americans love funny people. But I don't think of myself as funny. I know rarely... very funny people. But it's a thrill and an honor to think that I might make you laugh. I do sometimes when I'm reading and the audience laugh, I wonder if it's funny or if it's that I've made you so nervous, that I've said something so transgressive that we laugh, which is a nice way of putting me at ease. And
well, it might also be the voice of the writing, which
so
makes
glad.
Us nervous
yes.
sometimes.
Oh, yes.
Because the level of authenticity and honesty seems almost unbearable at times.
Well, this is the one book, if people were to say, oh, she's so angry, I wouldn't mind at all. People usually say it's that I'm very angry, and I always think, what, but I don't know what anger is. But I think as you get older, you begin to understand what anger is a little better, at least on a personal level, because the thing about, you know, the joy of life is undercut by the older you get, the end of the joy of life. And that's, no matter how joyful it is, the end of... If your life really has been wonderful, the end of it must make you angry. I know it will make me very angry. So as I get older and my voice, if people say it's anger, I'll understand. I used to object to it more. But the voice of, when you say girl, I think you were talking about the first piece of short story,
I wrote, which I didn't write really as a short story. I wrote it as a piece of writing. I've never really characterized my work while I was writing it, even though I know when I know what I'm writing is fiction, and I know that when I write about the botany of Southern California, that that's fact. I can distinguish, but I don't necessarily. I don't characterize. I use the same language and practically the same voice for both.
Mm-hmm. And in your writing process with this new novel, is it's still in progress? You're still working on it?
For the first time, I'm rewriting. I never rewrote before, but the reason I'm still writing it is because I'm rewriting it, that I understand things that I had, chapters I had written years ago and wouldn't release to my poor publisher, Jonathan Galassi. I understand why I wouldn't. I'd show them to him, but say, we can't publish it yet. I understand
it was
why.
This one.
Yes, yeah. I've rewritten it. He's quite, so far, quite patient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So your other books were all first?
All just first drafts. I've never rewritten
before.
I don't have any second drafts.
I think the only other writer I've read who's done that is Muriel Spark. He's done one draft.
Gosh.
And when you say you didn't think of it as writing a story, I know that your education as a writer, where you sort of went to school, Elizabeth Bishop says that the New Yorker was not a bad school to go to, and that's the school you went to as well. And
yes.
You know, being a young writer and being really hungry for experience and being in New York and having such a verbal imagination. That was where you did your time and you started writing, but you didn't think of yourself as a fiction writer or as a memoirist. You just wrote.
No, I just wrote. I knew I wanted to write. I spent about three seconds at a college in New Hampshire, which for my purposes no longer exists. It burned to the ground. If I thought I could get away with it, I'd say I didn't go to college at all. But there actually is evidence that I went to college. The president of this college was a very distinguished person, now the president of Bard College, named Leon Botstein. And it's not only that he can say, I went to Franconia College while he was president, but he actually has a photograph of me. I could say, well, it's his word against mine, but there is a photograph that I was at college. But I left in the middle of it and returned to New York without really any idea, because I wanted to be a writer. And now I cannot imagine why I did this, how I thought it would work, but I slept on people's couches and talked obsessively about my mother and wrote little things. And then one day I was introduced to the editor of the New Yorker, and I started. He said I should try to write, and I did, and he published it. And
at what point did you become Jamaica Kincaid?
The point I started to write about my mother clearly, and I thought that she would read it, and I thought that what I would write as a writer, I would be a failure, and that she would know that I had failed, and she would laugh at me, and I didn't want her to laugh at me, but I didn't mind failing, so I thought, I won't succeed at this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And so I changed my name and continued to write, and it was published. But actually, when I go over the whole issue of writing under a name, when I was a child and I
had the idea that I would, you know how when you're a child you pretend to be something? I don't even know if children do that anymore. because almost nobody is a child, for a very good reason. It's a hopelessly powerless position, and no one wants to be a child. In any case, when I was a child, I used to pretend I was something or another. Sometimes I would pretend I was a little English girl, and I had funny colored hair, and I did silly things, like spoke to my dog, or, you know, smelled flowers, or silly little English girl things. And then when I was a little older, I would pretend I was Charlotte Bronte. Mm. And that was my last fixed pretend. Mm. I don't think I ever pretended I was anything else after that. And I would pretend I was writing, and I was would pretend that I was penniless in Belgium, because I had read that she had been penniless in Belgium. So I would just sort of pretend I was cold and shivering and hungry in Belgium when I was actually living in the tropics. and was pretty well fed, I must say.
And was it Jane Eyre that you...
It was Jane Eyre that I read when... I could read very early in my life, and I would just read things. And someone had given me, a teacher, my French teacher had given me Jane Eyre as a punishment, actually, to keep me quiet. Mm. And I read it, and it did keep me quiet.
Many of your punishments seem to be the perfect punishment for
yes.
you, like writing out
yes.
Paradise Lost.
Yes, that was... that was a perfect punishment. Bridget is referring to a part of something I've just written in which a series of events I've narrated about how I became attached to writing and reading. And one of the incidents is that when I was 7 years of age, I misbehaved in class, and the punishment was that I should copy books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost. And the unexpected for the teacher, but not at all unexpected once you hear it, I fell in love with the person you're not supposed to fall in love with, the transgressing hero of Paradise Lost. And... and fall in love is exactly the word to use for my relationship to the hero of rule in hell than to serve in heaven.
And when I would like to go back, but we're going to open up to questions in a few minutes, so if you have questions brewing, save them for a second. I'd love to just go back to this question about writing and writing process and rewriting. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about if you do have a ritual, or you have some way of working and are finding new ways with the rewriting.
Oh, maybe finding new ways, which is always a good thing, to find new ways of writing. Though I must say, once I heard John Updike describe his process of writing, and it sounded really wonderful that he wrote fiction in the morning. I think he answered letters at lunch, and essays in the afternoon, and... I shall leave the empty spaces empty. I don't have that way of that kind of discipline. I write all the time in my head, and then I put it down on paper. But as I get older, I find that, certainly I'm finding with this, that when I put things on paper, I find fault with them, and so I've started to rewrite them. But I really have to be careful with that because I find fault in all my writing. The only writing I think is perfect is the writing that other people do. I much prefer reading to and writing.
Your reading, it just seems very voracious in that you read history, you read the ancients, you're reading the Marable book on Malcolm X.
Yes,
now.
Which I highly recommend. It's a great book. I'm reading that. But I think I would be an ideal white man in the 19th century who had a lot of comfort and a lot of people sacrificed. Well, a lot of people were dead for me to live in my little house in England and go off to the Galapagos and have all these wonderful ideas about the origins of the species and, you know, sit in a little place in Oxford and figure out geography and, you know, and while the rest of the world just died because of my little comforts, and I would have all these ideas about liberty in the afternoon. Well, that would be my... Yes, a really horrible guy in England in the 19th century.
So you would turn the tables. I did have another question about the writing process with Among Flowers when you go to the Himalayas. And did you keep a notebook?
I did keep a notebook of mostly of the plants we were seeing. Though to be fair, I was so terrified all the time of one thing or the other, you know, the Maoist gorillas or leeches or the potatoes not cooking properly, and it's very bad to eat undercooked potatoes. Why do I get the feeling you're laughing at me? Well,
but and there's so much also about the garden, and you know, you sacrifice so much for your garden, going to collect these seeds, and I love this final two paragraphs, and I wonder if you might from Among Flowers, and there's so much about the garden in the new novel.
Yes, that's true. Let's see. It's as I walked and observed each plant, be it tree, shrub, or herbaceous perennial. As I walked and observed each plant, be it tree, shrub, or herbaceous perennial, seemed perfect in its setting or in its sighting. I was in fact looking at nature or the thing called so, and I was also looking at a garden. The garden is an invention. The garden is an awareness, a self-consciousness, an artifice. We think and feel that we are making something natural when we make a garden, something that if come upon unexpectedly is a pleasure to behold, something that banishes the idea of order and hard work and disappointments and sadness, even as the garden is sometimes made up of nothing but all that. Eden is never far from the garden's mind. It is the garden to which we all refer, whether we know it or not, and it is forever out of reach. As I walked up and down the terrain in the foothills of the Himalaya, looking for plants appropriate for growing in the garden, I am now, even now, for the garden is ongoing, and a stop to it means death. Making in Vermont, the strangeness of my situation was not lost to me. Vermont all by itself should be Eden and garden worthy enough, but apparently I do not find it so. I seem to believe that I will find my ideal, more a true ideal, only if I can populate it with plants from another side of the world.
And that seemed also so much to be about writing to me. And when you write about gardening, it does seem so much about writing and your way of describing the garden, your relationship to plants, I think that's why that moment at the dinner table is so painful when the deer come and eat the tulips and there's such relish.
Yes, and I hope that the those of us who are not gardens, the reason, gardeners, the children, when they say, who ate the turban, that the tulip is called tulip because it comes from, originally from a part of the world where people wear turbans. And when it was introduced to as a new plant to Europe, it was called a tulip based on it looking like a turban. Mm. So when the children say, "Dear, ate the who ate
the, your turban? Dear, yes. Dear ate your turban.
Turban, yes, yes."
Should we open it up to the audience?
My mind, when I look at the options that I have for reading, if you look in an audio book or an e-book or a paper book, I've always thought that I would prefer, and I've always preferred, to read the book and hold the book in my hand.
Yes.
With you, for the first time, I think I actually enjoyed hearing and got as much from it, and I'd like to know how you feel that the commerce of literature affects your process.
Oh. Well, to be shallow, it affects my process when I see the enormous amount of bills I have to pay. It doesn't really matter to me. Of course I write books, I make my living, part of my living through them, but I also am a reader, I don't listen to books so much. I love the teaching company for all those lectures, but I tend to buy a book, a real book, and then if I, for some reason, have to take it with me, I have one of the old Kindles. They're only 2 years old, but they're old by now. But I don't think as far as I know, it doesn't affect me. I'm not really a big author, you know. So I don't really know how to answer that question about the commerce. I have an agent.
and you've taught, and one of your students is here, who was a student at Harvard, and I remember there was this thing at Harvard when you take a creative writing class. Everyone wants to take it. It's very hard to get into them. So all the creative writing teachers stand up and say, to get into my class, you have to do this exercise. And I'll never forget your exercise, which was to read the Elizabeth Bishop poem in the waiting room, yes, and then to write something about waiting that couldn't be set in your dorm room.
Oh, God. Oh, I think I gave the poor students at Harvard a hard time because they were at Harvard and they expected, because they're just going to go out into the world and give people a hard time.
Tessie?
Whoa! Sorry.
It's quite hard.
I never knew just how to describe your writing to anyone, and I've loved it for years. But now I know I would say you're like a cross between Sonny Rollins and Monty Python.
Wow.
But anyway, I do have a kind of a serious question. You know, Sven Burkitz has talked about you in his book, Time and the Art of Memory. And he says, yeah, well, you know, he doesn't write like that at all. But what he's basically saying is Auntie John is... You know, she calls it a fiction, but really it's memoir. And, you know, when somebody just does that, how does that make you feel? Because I hear you say, you know, I know I'm writing fiction, and Annie John, I thought was, you know, your fiction.
Yes. Oh, well, I didn't know he had said that. I, of course, would never read anything of his. But I'm sorry I wasted his time. I wouldn't know. The only thing I would say to him is that he really shouldn't go around telling people what they have said, they have done. If I tell him I've written fiction, he really ought to take my word for it.
But just to say with the Sven Burkert's book, is that what he's doing is he's looking at it alongside memoirs, and he's saying, of course, it's fiction, but as elements of memoir. And so just to be fair, he isn't coming down solidly in one. No, I actually just read it the other day. I reread it. So, but he praises the book, and he looks at the shape of the book and time and how obsessed with time so many of us seem to be. And I am right now because it's 8:12 and we have till 8:15. And so I think we have time for a couple of more questions. Yes.
Question. I'm intrigued, besides the fact that you're so funny, I'm intrigued by your lack of rewriting. And I'm wondering if somewhere along the line somebody said to you, you know, you're supposed to rewrite, or maybe no one ever told you that. So I'm just intrigued by that. Would you talk about that, please?
First of all, if anyone tells me to do anything, it's just the thing I won't do. And I wouldn't. I wouldn't do. I had a great editor named William Sean, and he was the sort of person who could persuade you to do anything. And I remember once writing something, and he wanted me to change it. He was going to publish a short part of my novel, Annie John, my novel, Annie John. And I said something, and he wanted me to change it. I won't tell you exactly where it is. And I said no, and we went back and forth. He said, won't you please change it? I said, no, I'm not going to change it. And he said, finally he said, you know, and he named all these great writers, Philip Roth, Saul Bellow, Salinger. They happened to be all men, incidentally. He said, well, they'd all change things for us, and he would call the magazine Us. And when they published it in book form, they put it back. And I said, well, they shouldn't have. I never changed it, and he published it. So I've always had a sense of, I'm not saying it served me well, because I can't be entirely right. But I've always had a sense of that, when a powerful person wants me to do something, and for the most part, a reader is a powerful person, it's just the thing I won't do. I think I write the way I write, and if someone says, well, you know, or if I even have an inkling that I should rewrite it, I just won't do it. This book I'm writing, and practically I just am changing things. It would have been published a long time ago because people wanted it published, and perhaps that's why I never published it. But it's not, you know, that I'm just sort of, what do you want me to do? I'm going to do the opposite. It's just that things have worked out that way. I haven't rewritten because I haven't found it necessary to do so. But I think now I do. And I mean, if you were asking me for some advice, is that you should always do what in your writing, and I wouldn't give you life advice, but you should do what you think would be the thing you can do. I would love to write. Oh, my friend David is a We have a private joke in which he tells me, and none, when you're done with that, you will write the best, the bodice ripper. And I would love to, but I can't. I do what I can do, and I do it fully, I think. It's not that I don't rewrite. I haven't felt it necessary to do so before. Incidentally, I've never really spoken this unguardedly about how I approach writing, and so maybe I no longer care what.
we can take two more questions, Louise says.
Good evening. Hello?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes. My name is Bronte. Would you like to say hello to me?
Hello? Yes? Miss Bronte, hello? Charlotte or Jane?
Oh.
Both? Well, now there's got to be, and that's not a question. Go ahead.
On the subject of your writing, I love the use of repetition in your writing. I love its the rhyming quality that it creates kind of within the text and the musicality of the language. But I kind of got a new take on it from a piece of the excerpt that you read when you said something to the effect, she said it twice to make it real, something to that effect, I'm paraphrasing.
Yes.
So can you say a little bit about that use of repetition really in so much of your writing?
I think the influence of that is that, again, another thing I read obsessively as a child is the King James Version of the Bible. That's an influence and a great big influence on the way I use words. The other thing that's an influence on my writing, which I don't so much talk about, it's another thing that happened when I was 7 years old. For my 7th birthday, my mother gave me, as a present, a concise Oxford English Dictionary, and I read it from beginning to end. Because I had nothing to read. I just loved to read, and I had nothing to read. So I read the dictionary. And you can see that words, the isolating words, are very interesting to me. So there are those two things. Plus, the influence of a lot of English poetry, English poetry up to a certain period. I think Hardy, a certain way of looking at the world, of reducing the world and at the same time expanding it, is English poetry is an influence on it. And I don't want to say Shakespeare, because we didn't really, you know, we were taught to read Shakespeare as a child. I had to memorize things or saw plays. But I don't want to say Shakespeare. I didn't really know Shakespeare in detail the way I knew the Bible. No, I know the Bible very, very well, the Hebrew Bible but earlier the King James version of the Bible. The Bible especially, where things are repeated, and there are many reasons, as biblical scholars can tell you, for that. But for me, it was the influence it had was things are they have the same words said more than once, or the same sentence said more than once. It's another dimension. Even though they're the same words, you say them again, they enter the ear in a different way. Your voice hugs them in a different, your ear, everything changes, though they're the same. And so that's a big influence on that understanding, is deeply ingrained. I was going to use the word embedded, but it's been destroyed by war talk. But ingrained, yes.
It was very interesting that you just talked about power, and many of your characters would be considered not traditionally powerful,
people or in positions of power, but they really are very strong and they're looking for their place and for their piece of power in the world. Do you think about that when they're writing them? I mean, you just mentioned if a powerful person tells you to do something that you wouldn't. Do your characters speak to you like that about what their power is, and they, all of their powers are very different. So do you think about power situations or
all the time
when you're doing that?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. The I think very early on I was aware of the dynamic of powerful and powerless. And as I said earlier, the most powerless person in the world is a child, you know, which is why you want to grow up pretty quickly. Or we live in a society in which children... Well, that's a whole thing to go into. But yes, the truth is, I think about... it's not that I think about power as I think about what would be the just... What would be the true just thing? And the minute you start to think about those truth and just, true and just, you are talking about power. Or you begin to enter the realm of how that is... arranged.
And description is a part of what you're doing.
Yes.
So well that
oh
that brings back the balance in a way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. To go back to the repeating is to try to see if what I've said is the true thing, and then you go on from that, and that, and if it isn't, then how to say it again so that it is aired out and made true and made just.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, everyone.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.